brutality and unjust laws cannot defeat us. Who'll defend the workers who cannot organise when the bosses send their lackeys out to cheat us? Money speaks for money, the devil for his own. Who comes to speak for the skin and the bone? What a comfort to the widow, a light to the child. There is power in a union, the union forever defending our rights. Down with the blackleg, all workers unite. With our brothers and our sisters, together we will stand. There is power in a union.
And that does it for today's show. If you'd like to get a copy or see this show or the transcript, the podcast, video or audio of this show or any of our debates or coverage of the 2016 election or anything else on global politics, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzdern, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Gadars, and Anthony Manzo. And to our camera crew, John Randolph, Karen Krugmeadows, Anna Ozbeck, and Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman, our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much for joining us.
KABLE's membership drive is coming up in September. Help us promote the work of this amazing station by following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and now Snapchat, rating our app on the iTunes and Google Play Store, and joining our Facebook event for the upcoming membership drive. Oh, and don't forget to join or renew your membership. Just click donate on our website or app and start your monthly contribution to your community radio, KBOO.
Join KBOO Community Radio at Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, September the 8th for United We Stand Up, a comedy show and a benefit for KBOO. I'm T6 and I'll be your host that night, which will feature local comedians like Betty Lungen, Bree Pruitt, Adam Potsey, Brandy Morgan, Belinda Giles, Noriko Ott, and Debbie Wooten. Raffles, refreshments, and good times for all. Again, that's United We Stand Up, Thursday, September the 8th, at Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. Doors at 6:30, showcase at 7:30. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The KBOO Evening News is off tonight. It will return tomorrow night at 5 p.m. Instead, tonight we bring you the first two episodes of the KBOO podcast, Bread and Butter.
Their blog, Pete's World. Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Sam Bowman. Greetings. Welcome to the Bread and Butter Podcast. We have a seat for you right over here. If you could just... Yes, excellent. I'll bring you some water in a minute, then some crayons for the kids. There you are. And you. Great. Now, thank you for listening to the first episode of Bread and Butter, a podcast devoted to the voices of people who have stood up to their boss, company, landlord, the centers of power in our everyday lives, and taken the consequences. There are often no manuals for this sort of action, and it is easy to be cynical about the prospects of organizing your coworkers, filing a wage claim, or contesting an eviction notice. This show aims to bring together stories from people who have done these things. Many of them were not successful, but their stories can help demystify what your rights are and how to protect them in the fundamentally unbalanced relationships that define the bread and butter of American life. Because together we can... Sorry. Yes, of course. That was the linguine parmesan. And yes, chicken strips for the kids. Okay. I'll be back in a little bit with your food. Y'all folks, enjoy the show.
The sunrise. And set for you. But the same sunrise and set and shine on the football. You turn it around. I myself would even like a little higher ground. But it's high time that you find the same people you walk on your way.
I think it was in, let's see, when did I start there? I think it was 2011 or 2010. I started working at Pete's, and there were some other people working there that had been working there for a couple years beforehand that were part of the group.
That's Claire Valentine Fossum. She's a native of St. John's who moved to Illinois for college in 2005 and stayed in Chicago after graduation, working at one of Chicago's Pete's Coffee and Tea shops. Pete's Coffee and Tea is a company that's familiar to Portlanders, but back in 2010, they were still moving into the Chicago market. Pete's began as a coffee-focused Bay Area chain that built its customer base on warm customer service and close attention to quality in coffee roasting. At one point, CEO Pat O'Day said that what makes his company great is that they, quote, challenge the status quo through the lens of our values. However, in the years preceding Claire's employment at Pete's, the company experienced major growth and reorganization, which was experienced by shop staff as new rules about speed, less focus on coffee quality and customer service, and a new disconnect with the corporate end of the company. These issues were soon a regular topic of frustration and discussion among Claire and her coworkers.
Basically, we kind of started talking about how there were a lot of issues with safety in the cafe, and a lot of concern with especially like wrist safety and ergonomics when you're working on the machines. And so we kind of started talking a little bit about that, and a few of us had backgrounds in organizing previously, and so we kind of just started talking like, well, is this something we can solve through organization, and is this something we can solve through a union? And so I was a shift lead, which is sort of like a supervisory position, and you're trained onto the proper procedure to pull an espresso shot, the proper procedure for using the coffee machines. And these are procedures that are put in place for safety. But in the real world, when you're trying to implement these things, it's not really possible with the speed that they're also requiring you to put the drinks out at. And so a lot of what we were trying to do was to bring those rules back and actually take action and do those things. So we're using both hands to pull an espresso shot instead of doing the quick way, which is one, but causes wrist damage. And so a lot of what we were kind of gathering behind was, let's start using these safety procedures in the workplace. And we're gonna, and bringing people in and saying, use both hands. And there's a thing called a bump screen, where the drink goes up on the screen, the drink order, and when you're done with it, you push the button that says you're done. But the problem is that you get so many drinks in at once that it's just flying, and you're flying trying to make the drinks, and so people will push the done button and then bring them back because if the drink goes over 30 seconds or something, some ridiculous number like that, it changes color and you get a red flag and then you get marked. You know, you have to go talk with the manager if you have too many of those, and it just makes you look really bad. There's a printout at the end of the day that says who's the slow person. And so there's a big, push if you want the hours to go really fast and to risk your body and your wrists. And so that was their biggest thing because everyone was experiencing that. At one point, we used to have three people on the floor. Then they kind of remember the day they cut us back to two people. Legally, you have to have one person or two people there. You can't have one person there. So that basically it was the bare minimum to get everything done, to make the drinks, to take the orders, to get people their coffee beans, to clean the store, to make sure the bathrooms are clean, to restock everything on the floors, to just greet customers when they come in, to sell merchandise. And you can imagine during coffee rush, before and after work, or when the schools get out, or there's a big event, that that's just not feasible. So that was a big rallying point, was this is not safe, what the practices that were going on. And then after that, it was things like hours, equality in the workplace. But the biggest thing, I think, was safety, and that was the biggest rallying point. Also, this idea of having the employee work off the clock for free because of compassion for their other employees, which is a big thing we're seeing now. Totally illegal to work off the clock, right? Yet people are working on their break. Why? Because we're short-staffed, and that's your friend out there getting hammered and you feel compelled to help them, or because you're a supervisor and you don't have enough time to do your paperwork on the clock because you have to work the floor because it's you and one other employee. So you're doing your paperwork then on your break. And I think there's a lot of reliance on that model as well. And this understanding that, well, this person this person cares about their coworkers. They work with them every day, and they can't really take a break. They have to go help on the floor. And that was actually a really big challenge with some of our people that we were working with, was getting them to say, no, I'm on break. And yeah, things are going to crumble, but no, I'm on break. And this is my legal break. And I need to sit down, and I need to rest, and I need to eat some food, and I need to use the bathroom. That was a big deal. Like, just getting people to stop and say, I need to use the bathroom. And that was a really big challenge, I think, that we worked with, because that's so ingrained in everybody, is I don't need a break. I don't need a break from the register. I don't need a break for lunch. I don't need a break from the coffee bar. My wrists are fine, even though they're bandaged up. Your wrists aren't fine. And that was a really difficult challenge that we also had to face, was trying to get people to say no.
The fledgling Pete's Workers group realized it would need to be careful about who they talked to. Organizing workers at small shops that are part of a larger non-union company is a subtle craft that must take in the differences between shops, workers, and managers.
Actually, I just saw a quote by Cesar Chavez today about how, you know, you talk to one person, and then you talk to another person, and then you talk to another person. And it was a lot of that. So I guess it was a lot of talking to people, but it was a lot of trying to figure out how to speak to people. And that was the really hard part, was you can't be too aggressive when you're speaking to someone. You have to figure out kind of where they're coming from, and also what's going to click for them, and sort of make it like on their level, something that they want to do, not something that you're sort of forcing onto them. And so we just started, you know, a couple of us started talking to some other people, and then they got involved. And then as that grew, we branched out from there, with people coming in with different ideas and different strengths. And then we started having meetings, and just sort of getting the ball rolling that way.
And like, to what degree was that secret from the management?
So we wanted to keep it a secret in a way, not just from the management, but in general from the higher corporation. Because there had been previous times when other cafes had been trying to organize, and they were just immediately shut down. So we wanted to make sure that we had a really strong base before we kind of came out as an organization. We didn't want it to get destroyed in the very beginning, before we could actually, you know, establish ourselves. So it was secret, I guess, almost 5 months, I guess, before that, which was really hard, because you're talking to people and you want to get more people involved, and you want them to understand that the management isn't at fault here. They're dealing with the same issues basically that we are. They're having to cut labor. They're getting direction from the top that they probably don't want to deal with, and they know people need money and hours, and so we're trying to show them that this isn't against the management, but at the same time, we can't really speak to the management about this yet, because they will have to immediately report that there's an organization starting. And that's also a big word, with the union word was really big, and trying to come up with other words that we, instead of using the union word, because that's an automatic red flag, especially if management hears that. So we kind of came up with like a list of demands and a good solid like group of people that were on board with those demands before we even published what we are doing. And we published that by giving them a letter basically of our demands.
At the time, there were only two Pete's shops in Chicago.
So it was one in Chicago and one in Evanston, which is a suburb directly outside of Chicago. So at the store that was located directly in the city, the management was really new. People didn't, they knew the management, but they didn't necessarily have a lot of trust in the management from the very beginning because they didn't know them. So to build that group up was a bit easier because there wasn't an allegiance or this breaking of your allegiance to the management. Whereas as a store I worked at, the manager had come up as a barista and everyone, you know, and people were friends with her and they invited her to their, you know, to their wedding. And she came to barista espresso pouring championships. And so some people had issues when they were working at that store with, I don't want to hurt the manager here because, you know, we like her. And she was a great person, you know, that she's a good, honest, hardworking person that really does understand that people need hours. So there was some issues with people trying to bring people in from that store because there's that question of, well, I don't want to hurt my friend and I don't want to hurt my friend more than I want to join this organization. And so that was really hard, especially when you would talk to somebody there and you would reveal that to them what you're doing. And it would seem like this was a good idea that they're on board. And then maybe a week later, suddenly everything's out. And that happened. And that was kind of the big turning point of, oh, now we're outed because we had told people, and this was a risk. This is a risk you have to take is when you're trying, you know, you have to start talking to people. That's how you build an organization. But there's a risk that someone might leak your plan before you're ready to.
On September 3rd, 2012, the Pete's Workers Group went public and delivered their letter to management and then braced for the consequences.
Yeah. So I was there when they first had the letter and it was this weird, it kind of was weird. It was, someone wrote this letter and it's going to be presented. And because we were showing people their letter that we were going to, this is the letter we're going to be presenting, the rough draft of it. And this is kind of where we're coming from. These are the talking points that we have, safety first. And then, you know, stable hours, stable work environment, things like that. And so suddenly, oh, there's this letter being written. And who's writing it? That was the big question. Is Claire writing it? No, Claire's not the one writing it. So who's the one writing it? You know, and it was this big deal to find out who's the one writing it, which was funny, though, because it's not a who. It's the organization. It's the product of lots of people. So that was kind of funny when they're like trying to figure it out. And well, you can't figure it out because it's everybody, but it's nobody because it's ours. And what are you going to do? Fire everybody because you found out that maybe there's a letter. And so that was there. And then I know with the other stores, I guess later on what happened is after that came out, they presented the letter and then there were some issues where people were basically fired for being organizers. It didn't say that outright, but so Pete's has this rule, they did at least then, where if you're late by more than 5 minutes, three times in a year, you get fired. And that rule is only used to get rid of people that they don't want. It's not used for people that, like, it's not across the board, everyone is subject to that rule. It's only really use it for people they don't want. And they'll scramble your hours around, your schedule around a lot so that you maybe are late. And then they'll fire you. And so that was used with one of the organizers and who she had to, you know, be there at 4:30 in the morning and was late more than 5 minutes. And the management didn't mind, but the corporate headquarters called in when they had seen her three strikes and said, fire her. Because they knew she was one of the major organizers of the group. And then from there, actually, there was a lot of support from the customers that knew her because she had been there for so long and rallying behind her and trying to, you know, signing petitions to get her job back. There were protests outside the store. The customers were supporting it, which was really cool because they were like, no, this person's a hard worker and she deserves her job and she deserves to work in a safe environment. And you know, I agree with what they're proposing here. So that was a really good feeling, even though that people were getting, you know, fired or threatened.
Yeah. And in general, how was the customer response to this sort of thing?
So at that store, I think there was a little bit more solidarity from the customers because...
And I'm sorry, that's the store
in Chicago. Yeah.
Okay.
So in the central store, there were more people on board in general with the organization. And there were more, I think, customer support because you had a lot of people that were regulars. Well, there were regulars at both stores. The other store, there was a lot of turnover, I guess, in the staff. A lot of the staff are students. And so there was some customer support, but... not as much, I think, as we were hoping for, especially from like the college that was nearby. We were trying to organize with the college in some respects, but it was really difficult to get students involved and to get students that were working there involved because it was, okay, yeah, I care about this issue, but I have homework and I'm going to be gone in 4 years and this is a temporary job, a part-time job. It's not my livelihood. Like it might be for someone at another store. Plus they all knew that the manager there. And so they were like, I don't want to, you know, I love the manager. I don't want to do anything against the manager.
Yeah. And do you remember any of the forces against it at all? Like the actions that were taken, if any?
Well, the biggest thing I know that someone was fired and there were threats to people that were petitioning to get the person their job back. Threats. There was one coworker that was sitting outside on her break when the petition was being signed outside the store. And she, her like corporate affiliates came down and basically came to that store and they're saying, you know, you're going to get fired. She's like, I'm just sitting out here on my break eating, you know, like a sandwich or something. And, oh, well, you got to go back in the store. You're going to get fired. And so there was a lot of that, a lot of threats, just, I mean, anything to stop it, basically, as well as cutting people's hours once they found out that someone was organizing.
In addition to hostility from corporate, the organizers became very familiar with the problems of trying to organize workers in the service industry, with its high rates of turnover, low job security, and pervasive cynicism stemming from the general view of the American service industry as something you get out of rather than try to improve.
It's really limited. I mean, it's really limited when you're trying to organize, even in the nation or just at your store, when you're working with people that they're only working there part-time. They're just barely making it. They've also got maybe another job. They've also got other commitments, family, school, you know, the rest of their community. There's other separations between you, maybe like age differences or language barriers. And so I think that was a really difficult challenge that we were facing that maybe like other unions in the past haven't faced, which is exciting in some ways because it's new. And these are new challenges that we'll have to deal with if we want to organize, like, basically service workers is looking at these challenges. And it was good to get that out of the way and talk to the Starbucks union or talk to IWW and figure out how do you like overcome these challenges.
Quick sidebar here, folks. Yes, the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies, are still a thing. Portland has one of the country's more active branches, the IWW we all learned about from our high school textbooks with its bombs and vast marches is a thing of the past. But the current incarnation is having an impact on modern organizing concepts. I spoke last year with Ryan Gowan, an organizer with the Portland chapter at their local offices, a converted house on East Burnside Street. He explained the difference between traditional unionism and the style of organizing that characterizes the Pete's Workers Group.
So public, by that term, we mean that there's like the union has been certified as the bargaining agent for workers there. So it's an actual like legal relationship where people who work there have the protection of union membership status. And in those shops in particular, they have contracts or collective bargaining agreements in place. So that's what we mean by public, is that the workers there can very publicly state that they're union members. But the vast majority of the organizing that we do is actually under the radar. So we do a lot of organizing with workers, particularly in the service industry, where the union is like not common knowledge. Our strategy is to get workers together to try to strategize about making things better at work and making change happen at work and having them act in concert with each other to make that change happen. Now, the employer may or may not know that there's union activity involved, but they know it when they see it. They know when they see workers approaching them with a demand that that's some kind of organized activity. So a lot of what we do is educating workers on how to organize and take those steps themselves. And that's our particular brand, if you will, of unionism. It's called Solidarity Unionism.
One of the most prominent organizing efforts the local IWW has been involved in is the Burgerville Workers Group, which went public earlier this year and has tenaciously pushed their case with the Vancouver-based company since then. The IWW has also worked with workers groups at Starbucks and Jimmy John's, as well as a handful of social service agencies. The differences between the two types of organizing Gowan described also came to the fore during the struggle to start the Pete's Workers Group in Chicago.
So internal challenges definitely come up when you have multiple locations that are trying to organize under one roof, as opposed to, say, just like you just have a factory and everyone's there at the factory and everyone knows everybody. And that can might be easier than, okay, now there's six factories, or there's two factories, or there's two coffee shops like we had. And someone that can be difficult for trust issues. Maybe someone at coffee shop A doesn't really know the organizer over here at coffee shop B. So they might agree to it, but they don't really know this person. So we would try and organize events outside of work. But once again, you're running into other commitments that people have. But just so that was a challenge of trying to get everyone on the same page when they didn't work together. We would also have people come from one store to another store to try and sub in and talk with people there. It was really strong at the store in Chicago, the organization was. It wasn't as strong at the store where I was at in Evanston. And so we would have people from the Chicago store come and try and work at the Evanston store and just kind of, this is who I am. Now you know who I am. Also, here's this thing we're doing. We're organizing and I'm part of the group. Other internal struggles we had were making the demand letter, and communication was a really big challenge when you're just communicating by email or phone, as opposed to seeing someone every day in the workplace. It can become kind of difficult to try and organize and get everyone together on the same page, on the same like list of, I think there were like so many drafts of the list of demands. And some people, let's just do it. Like, it doesn't matter what kind of paper it's printed on. Let's just get it out there. And other people will know it does. Everything should look super professional. So we want it to be on this really nice paper, like a real letter that we're going to send off to the company that we're going to have people sign. So there were, you know, challenges of when do we come out and when do we present ourselves and how do we talk to people and is this person safe to talk to, basically. So there was a lot of that internal challenges of going on. I think those are the biggest things that I kind of wish that we had been better at communicating, I think.
And so that, just from my own personal experience in service work, I definitely noticed there's a certain brand of cynicism that people have about those kind of jobs, and just kind of, you know, this is terrible, or, you know, this isn't the greatest thing in the world, but I'll deal with it and I'll move on.
Mm-hmm.
Did you run up against that with a lot of people?
Oh, definitely. That was a big issue. I mean, it's not a career per se, right? That's not... Service jobs aren't really considered careers, except for when they are. And, you know, you've been working there for 8 years and you've been dealing with the same stuff going on. You've been dealing with the same, you have the same pay, you know, pay increases aren't going up. And so, but I mean, I think, and it's not just people working there, it's everybody. No one really views it. It's the customers. It's the people that are working there. It's since general society as a whole is you're a service worker. This is just, you know, this is just a job for high schoolers or students for part-time. You know, it's not really considered real, but it is real. And I think there is that cynicism that sets in with everybody then. And it's really easy to get burnt out when you're daily challenge is trying to overcome that, and as well as everything else that you're doing. And then also, I think that the other challenge in there, aside from that probably adds to the cynicism, is the speed that you have to get everything done at, and then you're exhausted. And how do you organize after that?
Or you work really hard to get more hours and then spend those more hours doing the same thing.
Right. Or, you know, you work a 40-hour job and another, you know, job, you know, or you're maybe, or actually you don't work 40 hours because no one gets 40 hours anymore, but you work a part-time job and another part-time job and another part-time job, and you still don't have, you know, benefits, but you have to make money. And how do you organize then if you've got no time because you're working or like sleeping pretty much or taking care of your kids?
As you can probably tell, it's not hard to let discussions between service workers devolve into kvetching and shop talk. But the frustration is real and stems from something organizers call the disposable employee model, used, consciously or not, by many service industry employers. This is the idea that even though high turnover has its costs and the frequent training of new employees, it is worth it because the company has to give few to no benefits to part-time workers who will in turn become frustrated and leave and be replaced by a fresh crop of desperate workers willing to work part-time for low pay and no benefits. This was a concept the Pete's workers were not at first aware of, but it soon became a central part of their case against the company.
I don't think that was something that was something, I guess, in the back of our minds, but I won't say it was like a defined concept in the very beginning. Once again, the beginning was just about safety, pretty much. But then we also were talking about the disposable employee, that three strikes and you're out rule, or the, you know, this week you get 10 hours, next week you get 15 hours, next week you get 7 hours, and then 3 hours. Well, why would anyone stick around? Well, it doesn't matter because they can leave and you can get somebody else in, and then you'll have to spend a bunch more money training them and time training them. But they're coming in and they're working part-time and they're not getting benefits and they're, you know, working for a low wage. So that doesn't, the time spent, I guess, training them isn't really seen as a big issue on the outside. On the floor, it definitely is, because then, you know, you've got someone that's inexperienced and you're trying to help them. But yeah, I think that there's not really a commitment to the employees, to as seeing them as people. It's really easy to just see them as people that are trying to sell coffee beans.
The Pete's Workers Group has been defunct since 2013, the same year Claire returned to Portland, but it has had an impact. The group and the worker Emma Bell Byrne, who was fired during the campaign, were profiled by the Atlantic Monthly last year in an article about millennials and unions. Their blog, petesworkersgroup.blogspot.com, is still up and has screenshots of the customer petitions, flyers, and the back-and-forth letters between the workers and the company. Most importantly, the group added their name to the growing list of service industry shops, most recently and locally Burgerville, that are organizing on the solidarity model, learning from each other's successes and mistakes, and gaining more ground and public acceptance every time. Thank you for listening to episode 1 of the Bread and Butter Podcast. It was written and produced by myself, Sam Bowman, for KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, with thanks to Alan Toussaint for our theme music. Thank you for listening. Stay strong. Here you go. Here's the check. And where'd you go?
Where?
Oh, what the hell? Come on. Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio. My name is Sam Bowman.
Hey,
what's up? Oh, you here for a stack?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great. Throw your crap over there for now.
Okay.
Put your shirt on, get ready. Hey, you brought your own knives. Sea schooler, eh? It's all right, we forgive you. All right. This here is Justin. He's our fry cook.
Yeah, what's up?
Over there is Sheila. She's the hostess.
Hi.
Yeah, she seems nice now. All right, here, take a look at this order. We just got this in here. Keep the specs up here. Take a look at that. What do they want here? Okay, we got an order for episode 2 of the Bread and Butter Podcast.
What's that?
Oh, you don't know what that is? Oh, Bread and Butter is a podcast. Hey, chop this onion while I'm talking to you, would you? So yeah, it's a show where we look at stories from people who have stood up to their boss or their landlord, whether or not they were successful at it, in hopes of demystifying and destigmatizing ways for workers and tenants to hold the powers that be in their lives accountable.
Well, that
stop talking, would you? Keep chopping.
Okay.
You ever made a podcast before? You need caramelized onions. This is going to take us a while, man.
Okay.
And if you want to work here, you got to hustle. And get a haircut, for crying out loud. Look at that.
Okay.
Cover up those tattoos. You got so many, they're probably weighing your arm down. I met 3-year-olds who could chop faster than this. Come on!
You think the sun rise, and set for you. But the same sun rise and set and shine on the purple too.
you turn it round. I myself would even like a little higher ground.
About 6.5 years of restaurant experience in different kinds of catering, smaller restaurants, larger restaurants, food service for about 6.5 years.
On the second episode of Bread and Butter, we're going to hear from Elaine, who's going to talk about the experience of initiating legal action against an employer in the food service industry. Specifically, we'll examine the process of writing and delivering a demand letter, determining what penalties may exist under your state's laws, and what sort of legal aid you can seek. Now, I should say that Elaine is not her real name, but she'll explain why later in the interview. You were involved in legal proceedings against a couple of employers, but the first and one that we're going to focus on today was in California, right?
Yeah, that's correct. In San Francisco, California.
All right. And yeah, that's your place of origin, am I correct?
Yes, the Bay Area, not specifically San Francisco. I'm from the East Bay myself.
All right. And can you just describe this job a little bit? Just like what kind of work was it? What was your position at the place?
It was a catering business that also had daily breakfast and lunch service in a very business downtown area of San Francisco. So there was a lot of catering orders to offices and things of the like. But we also vended for large events like festivals and things like that. I was a cook there. It was actually my very first cook position. I was initially brought on just to work one event. And then I was so eager to be advancing my career in cooking that they had me stage for a couple months. I would work one 6-hour shift a week, and I didn't have another job, and I was just holding out because I knew it was going to become a position for me, and it did.
And just for our listeners who may or may not have worked in the service industry, what is a stage?
Stage is essentially an internship. It is working for free so that you are able to get a foot in the door somewhere or learn the way that a certain restaurant works. In this particular case, it was more of a very entry-level internship-type position.
What was the atmosphere like at this place? Was it a consistent work atmosphere? Did you notice it changing over time?
It was consistent in that the owner, who was also the executive chef, who was there pretty much day to day, it was a family-like atmosphere in that sometimes things felt very comfortable and everyone felt a closeness, and other times there was a lot of really biting cruelty between the owner and some of his employees, like jokes that weren't really jokes. Things that were pretty unprofessional, but that, when someone laughs and says like, "Oh, I'm just kidding," you feel like you're not really allowed to say, but actually that's very upsetting to me.
Would you say that treatment was unequal, or do you think it was applied across the board to employees?
There were definitely certain people got different abuses, I would say. Our sous chef at the business was, on the one hand, relied upon greatly and praised for his great work. The chef also made fun of his body and his relationship. He had a long-term relationship with a woman who would actually help us serve at catering events often. And so to a certain extent, some people were targeted more about their relationships or their bodies. Another woman who I worked with, who was about the same age as me, we were both about in our mid-20s, would get made fun of quite a bit by the owner for her going out and partying. Even if it didn't affect work, he would have a comment about, the way that one day she would feel differently about things, telling her she was like Lena Dunham from Girls. Just like weird little microaggressions, I guess you could say.
And what eventually, let me put it this way, in as legally accurate a way as possible, what was the case that eventually was brought against your employer there?
Well, what I ended up approaching him with was that I wasn't being paid fair overtime. I was also not receiving fair share of my tips received from catering events and event vending at like festivals and things of the like. I was forced to take breaks out of my time card every day that I never once took. Every single day I took a break out of my time card that I never took. So there were a number of very clear labor law violations. I did also, in a less formal, through a less formal letter, I did also let the owner know that I had a number of, you know, potentially sexual harassment claims to make against him, because personally I had also been subjected to comments about my own body and jokes about having sex with members of my family and things like that. So the one thing that I did approach him about was the labor law violations, because those were pretty open and shut and provable. But in addition to that, there was a host of other complaints.
And can you go into the process a little bit of bringing those complaints to him? You said you did it in kind of two different ways.
So when I initially, I left that job for another position. When I left, it was a pretty heated departure. I was pretty much told to get out immediately when I told him that I had found a new position. And I didn't get a chance to kind of tie up loose ends, you know, give him the keys to the restaurant and things like that. So when I was approached about getting those keys back, I sent him a letter that basically said, I could potentially go after you for some of these violations. And I will send you your keys. But, you know, if you continue to be aggressive toward me, I can come at you with legal action. Probably about 6 to 9 months later, after reflecting on all of it and really thinking about how much money I had lost, I decided that I was going to take the step to try to pursue that. So I sent a demand letter, and that actually yielded the hoped response, and I was able to settle.
Well, and I think a lot of people who are contemplating that kind of course of action don't really know where to get advice from. And did you have it like a lawyer or someone who was able to give you legal advice?
I have gotten some unofficial legal advice, and in this particular case, I was just did some research on labor laws for California. A lot of the in California, the labor laws are very much on the side of the employee, and BOLI here in Oregon also is there to protect employees. So there is actually quite a bit of information on their websites about clear information about the laws, about what you are entitled to as an employee in terms of overtime, breaks, you know, tip sharing and versus tip pooling, which is actually kind of a newer specific legislation here in Oregon. But I was able to just find information that clearly stated the violations from the California Labor Board. And so I just brought those to his attention and basically said, how are we going to fix this?
It sounds like there was kind of a swift outcome to it. Like he reacted sort of how you wanted him to? Or?
I had decided I was going to be moving to Portland, Oregon within a few months before I decided to pursue a settlement. So I looked kind of at how much money I had lost and thought that I wanted to pursue it. I made a rough estimate of how much money I had lost. I knew that I wasn't being tipped out fairly, for example, from some of our events, because I had seen the invoices that we had given to the customers and seen the amount of tip that they got, that they gave us, and then seen my portion of that. So I wasn't exactly sure on a number. I kind of decided that I didn't want to pursue it in court. And so I approached him with a number that I thought was fair for me, but also was probably less than I could have gotten. because of penalties. There is a considerable amount of penalties on those kinds of violations. And so I crunched the numbers a lot of different ways, and I found a number that I felt comfortable walking away from the situation with that I also felt I would be able to get. I mean, in this particular case, I felt very confident that I had a strong case because there were just numbers that didn't lie. I also had a number of witnesses who had worked with me for this particular business. I worked there for 2 years and a number of different events over those years. I could have called on any number of people to verify the information. In addition, like I said, to the actual numbers, which I knew would have proven me right. So I very much felt confident that if I approached him with a reasonable settlement, he would accept it. And he did.
And when you say penalties, you mean like things that would be assessed against him for as punishment for these violations in
yes.
addition to the original amount?
Yes. So things like not being paid fair overtime. You don't just get paid what you were owed. There is also, I believe at the time in California, it was about 50%. But there are penalties for not having paid it at the time because I was living without that income for however many months. And it's a law violation.
In that process, like personally speaking, were there any particular obstacles or challenges that you had to kind of get over to be able to do this?
Yeah. Personally, I definitely had a pretty big obstacle. As I said, it was my first job in professional kitchens, and I was really gracious when I was first offered that position to be given a start without any professional cooking experience. And I felt kind of a debt to him when I first left. That's kind of why I sent the letter saying I could come after you, but I won't, was because I felt a debt to him for giving me an opportunity. During the course of my working there, I would describe the atmosphere as abusive, and I don't use that phrase lightly, but the owner of the business, who was my superior, you know, every day of the week, would say things to me about how I